Colonel Michael Dimitriadi, Ville 2.
Well, of course, I didn't wake up in time, and I was very late getting up. I rushed up to the battalion orderly room to report to the adjutant, an awfully nice chap called the Honourable Bobby Best, later Lord Winford, who died quite recently. It was a funeral I went to in Dorset last year. And he wasn't best pleased, as you can imagine. Told me to get a motorcycle and follow the battalion up to Otterburn. I think it was Otterburn, anyway, somewhere up there. So I got a motorbike. I had only learnt to ride a motorbike, of course, at Octune, thank goodness I had. But I wasn't very competent on it, and twice I fell off on the way up. Once I broke a pedal off the bike and had to stop and have it repaired at a garage who were very kind and understanding. And I arrived, and I thought I'd done pretty well, because I hadn't got any real maps. I only had a few notes of places I had to go through to get there. And I reported to the adjutant up there, and I was immediately given 3 extra duty officers for my pains. But anyway, that's the result of being a green, young, inexperienced man. And that reminds me of an even more stupid thing that I did when I was still at the barracks at Wrexham. Because there was a great big parade ground, and nobody was allowed to venture across it. And also, people were very meticulous about saluting and so on and so forth. And as I stood beside it one day, I saw a young private soldier, or fusilier as we called them, coming, rushing across the parade ground with their hat on. And of course, as you know, people do not salute if they haven't got their hats on, except in the American army. And as he came up to me, he slowed to a quick halt and flung me up a terrific salute. And I said, stopped him, and I said, "Why did you salute me?" "Oh, sir," he said, "I'm very sorry. I thought you were an officer," which was the most wonderful put down that I've ever had. But he was so right, absolutely right, I hadn't made myself clear. Anyway, to return to our muttons, we trained in Yorkshire, we did exercises all over the county. Yorkshire's a big old place to do exercises on. And eventually we got orders that we were going to hot climates, and we were all issued with a tropical kit, or had to buy it in the case of officers. Smart pre-war tropical kit, complete with solar topias and everything else. And we went from there down to Cheltenham, where a lot of us were billeted on the race course. I was then put into what was known as the reinforcement company. In those days, a battalion going into action had a reinforcement company, which contained reserve specialist officers and a whole lot of other soldiers from one thing and another, which made the total strength of the battalion something like 1,000 men, whereas today, in today's army, a regular battalion is, 400 or 600 men, depending on how well it's recruited, very low indeed. There we were, 1,000 men. And we had all sorts of interesting people with us. In the First World War, the regiment had all the poets and authors, people like Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves, and Hedwin, the bard, Frank Richards, who wrote all sorts of books and one thing or another. In this war, we had all the actors. Jack Hawkins was with us. Andre Morel was with us. Hugh Griffiths was with us. Andrew Cruikshank, of all improbable people, was with us. He was once asked, I think, after the war, why he joined a Welsh regiment, and he said it was because he had to join the regiment which had had Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves in it. We had David Peel, a young actor, I think he was only in television, by and large, and Desmond Llewellyn, who was taken prisoner of war. He was also in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, so we were quite an arty crowd, as you might say. The government had forbidden activities such as race meetings during the early part of the war, but when we were at Cheltenham, this was relaxed, and races were allowed again. And a lot of our soldiers who were billeted in the horses' stalls and stables on the race course had to move out at the weekends, let the horses in. And I think they had a rather ammoniacal return to those cells after the race meeting. But there were compensations for them, because they were required or allowed or invited to walk the course stamping in all the divots after the race meetings, and they got a little bit of money from the racing authorities for that purpose. So there we were in Cheltenham. Well, in Cheltenham I was sent off on yet another course, this time an intelligence course up at Matlock in the wintertime. Curiously enough, I'd done an intelligence course of a sort when I was in the OTC at Radley, but I found this a most interesting and useful course because it really taught me what are known in the army as staff duties, which stood me in great stead all the rest of my time in the army, because I was very much a desk waller rather than a chap with a rifle and a bayonet at the front. However, I got back from this course, and we were eventually ordered to given orders that we were going overseas, and we had to march down to the Cheltenham railway station, but no one was to know we were going to hot climates. And so although we had these great big woolsey helmets strapped on our backs, of our packs on our backs, we had to unroll and fold over them our gas capes, so that no one would think we had solar topes with us, all the ridiculous things. We entrained, didn't know where we were going. The following day we detrained at Gourock, outside Glasgow, and in due course embarked in the Empress of Canada, a huge, wonderful ship, which to our great advantage had just been victualled in Canada, and so it was full of all sorts of goodies, including a very good wine cellar. We were the best part of our brigade, it was 6th Infantry Brigade, with some of the ancillary troops attached to the brigade with us. We embarked and set forth in this convoy. I have details of it, but it's probably too tedious to recite them all. I remember we were crowded into a cabin, I think there were four in ours, and one of the occupants of our cabin was young David Graves, the son of Robert the author. And dear David, he never washed his socks. When he couldn't bear them anymore, they went straight out of the porthole and he started on another pair. Funny old trip this, because the idea was that we should not get soft during the voyage, and so we went for a route march around the deck every week. And of course this wasn't very popular with the sailors who'd scrubbed the decks, nor with the people living in the cabins just alongside the deck, because of the noise of hobnail boots stamping around their decks. However, we managed. And the CO started teaching Arabic. He knew Arabic, and we all thought we were going to the Middle East, so he started teaching the officers Arabic. Meanwhile, I tried to get a little battalion band going. We'd been given a portable piano by the acting colonel of the regiment, and we had some other instruments with us. And we sweated away in the very hot temperatures below decks trying to get this band going. It was never a great success. However, Jack Hawkins, who was with us at the time, did arrange a little sort of concert party on board, which I think was enjoyed by people. And two of the fusiliers arranged to operate their own canteen, because the ones arranged in the ship had such an enormous queue of people trying to get at it that it took them forever to get served. So they had an arrangement with the canteen manager to buy from him in bulk and set up another little canteen in competition, which did very well. In fact, I've just been reading his account of it. Unfortunately, that chap is no longer with us. So,
was there much threat, you know, during your journey?
Well, there was always the threat of submarines, and the officers used to have to take part in look out for submarines. I think we had something like four posts which we manned on a routine basis in sequence, looking out for submarines, particularly at night time. We never saw one, as far as I know. We called at Freetown, but we weren't allowed ashore. It was a very unhealthy spot. We went on south, and we went to Cape Town, where we were initially not allowed to disembark. until the second in command had gone ashore and returned with a generous supply of, believe it or not, condoms. The next day we were marched out to a camp called Retreat Camp, where we went in to do more training. One of the fascinating things about Retreat Camp, which I remember, were the latrines, which were a long, long line of buckets with normal wooden seats, and just hessian separating the back and between the seats, so designed that when you stood up, the seat automatically fell shut. So that was quite an interesting experience. We returned to Cape Town and learnt that the ship carrying our transport had been sunk by enemy action, so all our battalion transport had gone down. At that time, it became known that we were not going to Africa, but we were going to India. And our general, who had been travelling in another ship, he came on board with some of his staff, and for the first time, instead of having to travel at the speed of the slowest ship of the convoy, the Empress of Canada was able to put on speed and go flat out for Bombay on her own. The CO then switched rapidly from teaching Arabic to teaching Urdu. It was really rather a waste of time, because as people know, in India, any Indians who've been connected with the army in peacetime would all have a pretty good knowledge of English. However, it probably wasn't entirely wasted. We arrived in Bombay, and we went up then to a place called Ahmednagar, 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 which is near Pune, above Bombay, where we were billeted in, I don't know how appropriate it was, appropriately it was named, a place called the Stud Farm, which in fact was the headquarters and school of the Indian Army Armoured Fighting Vehicle units. Again, we trained and trained and trained, and this time we seemed to be training for amphibious operations. We did crossings of lakes in rubber boats. We had some time in Juhu, a beach above Bombay, where all the soldiers were required to pass out a swimming test of 50 yards with full equipment. I was appointed battalion swimming instructor, I don't quite know why, and I think most of them passed out by travelling with one foot on the bottom, but never mind. At Juhu, there was a very strong undertow in the when the tide was set in a certain way, and one day when I was there with the battalion, six men got into trouble all at once with the undertow, and I managed to get five of them home, back to shore alive, but the last one, I got him home and I couldn't save him. And the MO declared, pronounced him dead, although we tried all the artificial respiration that I'd learnt as a swimming instructor at Radley, but we lost him. Curiously enough, years later, or no, it wasn't years later, sometime later, when I was in the ordinary room tidying the commanding officer's papers of one thing or another, I came across a citation he'd written on me for that occasion, but he never posted it. However, after our training as amphibious troops, the idea had been that we should assault the island of Akiab off the Burmese coast with a view to capturing that as a base for supporting operations in Burma. We went across India by train and arrived eventually at Chittagong, where we studied this operation. I was already the intelligence officer of the battalion by then, because W. Reese, the battalion intelligence officer, had gone off to the headquarters of the 6th Brigade as a brigade intelligence officer. So here was I, as the intelligence officer of the battalion, making sand models and drawing maps and one thing or another, and planning for this invasion of Akiab. At that time, we had with us one bugler in the battalion, Fusilier Prince. He's a pre-war regular soldier, and he used to blow lights out in Reveille for us every night. Well, he didn't play Reveille every night, but he played lights out for us every night in Reveille in the morning. And he discovered that when I was at school, I had been the silver bugler in the band. And so he came to me one day and said, would you mind blowing up for me tonight, sir? I would like a night off. So I did that. Great fun. During our time at Chittagong, I was went to look at some particular spot. I can't remember what it was or why it was. I went by motorbike. And it was a very rough, uneven surface. And on the way back, I caught my right foot in a rock. And it was bent right onto the pedal of a motorbike. And when I got back to battalion headquarters, I was in agony. I simply couldn't get off the machine. I had to be lifted off. And I was put to bed in my office so that I could continue working. And I got a terrible row from the CO for making myself not exactly incapacitated, but certainly impaired. However, that passed. And while we were there, it became clear that we weren't going to do ACIAB because all the landing craft had been withdrawn for operations in Europe. So the next thought was that we would try and do the overland attack down the Mayo Peninsula, which had been unsuccessfully attempted by Indian Army brigades. Point. Perhaps I could just divert for a moment and talk about the British Army in India. As an all-British 2nd Division, we were extremely unpopular with the authorities in India. They didn't want British formations because they reckoned they were too expensive to feed. That was one of the main reasons. And also, being Indian Army-based, they didn't feel terribly keen on having British soldiers or British formations thrust upon them. Of course, the Indian Army had British battalions and British troops in them, but usually on the basis of one British battalion to a brigade of three battalions, the other two being Indian or Gurkha. And indeed, the story goes that when we first arrived in India, the RGOC, General John Grover, was invited to dine, I suppose it must have been with the governor of Bombay. And as he only just arrived from Europe, he wasn't sure of the form, and he got his ADC to ring up to find out what he should wear for dinner. And the answer came back, oh, mess kit, of course. And his ADC said, I'm very sorry. The general has only got service dress with him. Oh, well, they said, he'd better come in that. And that was rather the attitude towards British troops, or British formations, at least, at that time. Mark you, there are also elements in India who wanted Britain out altogether. And in fact, before we went across to the far side of the country, the battalion was sent down to Bombay to control routes amongst the mill workers who were demonstrating against the British troops. And there are a lot of stories that can be told about that. But here we are in Chittagong, preparing to prevent the Japanese advancing up through Burma and into India. Burma has mountain ranges which go north and south, and of course the axis of advance was from east to west for the Japanese to get into India. And one of their routes was up from ACIAB up the Mayo Peninsula, in order to strengthen the left flank of the Japanese advance. Now, at a place called Don Baik, which is a few miles north of Fowl Point, the bottom end of the peninsula, almost opposite ACIAB Island, the previous attacks had failed to dislodge the Japanese. And so our brigade, which at that time consisted of 1st Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, the 1st Battalion of the Royal Berkshire Regiment, the 2nd Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry, and for this occasion we'd been augmented by the 1st Battalion of the Royal Scots from our 4 Brigade. So we were a 4 British Battalion Brigade with the normal ancillary troops, including 2 batteries of our 99th Royal Buckinghamshire Yeomanry Field Regiment. who had screw guns. And there we were, preparing to go down this peninsula. So from Chittagong, we went across to a place called Tek Naf, where we celebrated St. David's Day in 1943, 1st of March. All sorts of improvisations had to be made. One of the traditions of the regiment is to eat the leek on that day, and we had to devise some sort of onions or spring onions to be used as leeks. We normally have a regimental goat on parade who goes round men's dinners. Well, a tiny little goat was discovered, and the pioneer platoon made a set of wooden horns for him, so he looked like a railway fusilier goat, and the other members of the unit made him a little harness to carry. We got a Burmese drum and made drumsticks for it, and a drum major's staff. And off we set with this goat round the men's dinners as usual. But unfortunately, the goat got worn out and had to be carried after a bit. It's a tiny little thing. I have a photograph of it. In the evening, we had the usual officers' dinner in the mess. And all these messes and huts and one thing and another were constructed out of bamboo, which we'd learnt from the locals to make quite speedily and very comfortably. And in the middle of this dinner, a cipher message arrived. And, of course, as the intelligence officer, it was my job to decipher it. And luckily, the best sergeant for this occasion was my intelligence sergeant. So we got into a huddle and tried to decipher this message. And we couldn't. It must have been corrupted. We never, never, never deciphered this message. I can't imagine what it was about, because there was never any reaction for not having done anything about what this message said. However, there we were. Now, while we were at this place, Tek Naf, it was decided that we should have mules. And, of course, all our transport hitherto had been jeep-borne or something similar. And our colonel, this time a man called Humphrey Williams, who was a pre-war territorial officer and had been in France with the 1st Battalion in Dunkirk, and was a schoolmaster, a Welsh-speaking schoolmaster, a wonderful man. He sat down with a towel around his head one night and he transferred all our battalion loads into mule loads. And when the mules duly arrived, I didn't think he had to change a single one. They were all beautifully worked out into loads which could be carried by mule. Off we set to attack Don Bike. We went to the line. It was a curious sort of situation because at this point the Mayu Peninsula is fairly narrow. It has a beach area on what would have been our right-hand flank on the west side and a very, very high spiny ridge on the left-hand side or the east flank of the advance. Very high, covered in jungle and bamboo, very difficult to get through. And the position we were due to attack was on what is known as a chong. Chongs are dried up riverbeds, or nullahs, as they're sometimes called, usually at this time of the year without any water in them, running down from the Mayu Hills, down across the plain and into the sea. And this particular one had a very distinctive bend in it at the end further from the sea, which was known as Shepherd's Crook because of its shape. Now, the Japanese positions in the Chong were well dug in and almost invisible from the front or even from the air. There was some talk that one or two of them might have been constructed out of tanks which had failed to get through their position, British tanks which had failed to get through and had been knocked out and incorporated into the defensive positions. I don't think this was ever really finally established, but certainly some people referred to steel doors on these bunkers which they either opened or couldn't open but never penetrated. Having taken over the line and seen what it was all about, we were then withdrawn for a couple of days to rehearse the attack on a particular position known as Sugar 5. Now, there were a number of sugar targets. These were numbers given by the artillery to various targets to identify them, so that instead of having to give a complicated six-figure map reference, you could say to the gunners, Sugar 5, and they knew exactly where it was. There were also monkey targets, which I believe are called mite targets, but the list I have calls them monkey targets. And in our battalion attack, we had one or two sugar targets to attack and one or two monkey targets to attack. But the main one was on Sugar 5. This was in a slight tributary to the main Chong, which pointing more or less towards our front line, whereas the main Chong went across our front. As I was saying, we were withdrawn for a couple of days before the attack to practice an attack over a similar piece of ground on a mock-up of this Sugar 5 position. I've read since that this was done for the benefit of the local press. Frankly, I don't believe it. I think it was really to give the troops a chance to attack over similar ground. I don't think it really was all that similar either, because there was nothing like the scrub and jungle around the thing we practiced on as there was in fact. The morning of the 18th of March, in very early hours, the attack went in. It was the Royal Welsh Fusiliers' job to clear this chong. The Royal Berkshires were in reserve, so were the Royal Scots, and the DLI were on our left to clear points at the bottom of the Bayou Ridge going south, and an Indian battalion of an Indian brigade was also with us further up the hill. Well, this attack went in, and the attackers were absolutely decimated. In fact, there has been some very good reports by senior officers as to how the attack should never really have taken place. And one of the sad things was that our commanding officer, Colonel Humphrey Williams, and our chief gunner, Colonel Mark Mansell, particularly wanted to put in an attack without artillery preparation, which would give the clear way that an attack was coming. But they were overruled. I think the brigadier also, Brigadier Cavendish also, was in favour of their plan. And he was overruled by, I think it was probably General Giffard, who was commanding the operations. And we had to have this preliminary bombardment, which was a great pity because it really gave the show away. Whether it would have made an awful lot of difference to the outcome, I do not know, because these Japanese positions are extremely strong, so strong indeed, that they could happily throw mortar bombs and grenades onto their own positions from other positions with impunity to those inside. It was just like that. They were very, very strong positions. This was always the case throughout the war against the Japanese, that I can remember. The attack was unsuccessful. I, at one stage, went forward to one of the companies, which was temporarily commanded by Captain Peter Fitch, and he went forward to see what was happening, and we heard a most frightful scream, and then silence. We presumed he'd been hit. And with my heart in my mouth, I went forward to find him and found him lying there, and I presumed he was dead. I hadn't ever had to identify a dead person before, and I've always to this day wondered if I really made the right decision, but I'm pretty certain he was. I debated as whether I could possibly get his body back, and I'm afraid I decided against it, so I took his watch back with me, and I felt that was the best I could do at that time. Meantime, young David Graves, our famous author's son, had got himself a lot of grenades and gone forward bombing his way against these Japanese positions. Very brave, supported by one fusilier with a Bren gun and perhaps one other man. He was last seen being hit and falling down, but nobody ever got to him, never got his body. We presumed he'd been killed, but we didn't know. The fusilier within got a decoration. But David, because we had to report him missing, believed, killed, was not allowed the posthumous Victoria Cross, which...